been extroverted and loved dining out, dancing and socialising. Before they took me on my first night out in Shenyang, they suggested I assumed a new name. This was for my own protection. The name they concocted for me was Chaemi Ran. I liked it. It seemed fun to use an alias. When my uncle and aunt's friends dropped by, I was introduced as Miran. I was visiting from Yangbian, they were told, the Korean region of China where many people speak Korean as a first language and may not speak Mandarin so well. The friends gave a knowing, ah, and accepted this explanation. Shenyang was a revelation. In North Korea, streets are dark and deserted at night. Here, the city came alive at sunset. The sidewalks of Taiyuan Street heaved with shoppers and young people my own age on a night out, boys and girls mixing together, stylish and laughing. Music boomed and throbbed from cars and bars. Everything seemed suffused with a kind of super-reality, as if I'd come from a world of black and white into one of technicolor. It was magical, an illusion enhanced by the myriad sparkling lights in every window display, restaurant and lobby, and on the fir trees that stood everywhere. Aunt Sanghee explained that they were Christmas trees, a Western custom that had caught on in China. Each evening we dined somewhere new.
"What are you in the mood for?"
my uncle would say, clapping his hands together.
"Chinese, Korean, Japanese, European, or something else?"
One restaurant had fish swimming in a tank illuminated in electric blue. I chose the one I wanted to eat. Menus overwhelmed me with choice. I ate ice cream every night. Aunt Sanghee showed me how to work the karaoke machine in the apartment. At first, I sang South Korean ballads with the volume turned low and the door closed, until she yelled from the next room, "Turn it up, I like that one!" In this country, there was no secret music. After that, they took me, along with a large crowd of their friends, to a noisy karaoke bar, another new experience for me. I could not believe I was singing my beloved Rocky Island in public, and got a round of applause. I had never enjoyed a night out so much. When, at the end of 4 or 5 days, Aunt Sanghee said, "Can't you stay a while longer?" I took no persuading. During the day, while my uncle and aunt were at work, I had to stay inside. But even that was fascinating. I could freely watch any television I wanted without having to close the curtains or keep the volume down or worry about the neighbours. This was pure freedom. Before I knew it, a month had shot by, and I had celebrated my 18th birthday in Shenyang. I could not delay my return any longer. My uncle said he would drive me back to Shanghai. These weeks had been such a whirl of discovery and enjoyment that I had given little thought to the implications of turning 18. The day before our departure, the home phone rang in the kitchen. My uncle answered it. His face tensed. Then without a word, he passed the phone to me. Behind the crackle and hiss on the line, the voice was faint. "Minyoung, listen to me." It was my mother. "Don't come back. We're in trouble." Chapter 21. The Suitor. I didn't know how she was calling. We didn't have a home phone. She would not have called from her workplace because the Puibu monitored the line. Wherever she was calling from, it was dangerous. She was speaking quickly. She wasn't angry. She had no time to tell me off, or for any chit-chat. "The day after you left, they started a census for the next elections," she said. I felt myself break out in a sweat. Every so often the authorities register voters in order to find out who was missing and why. I had turned 18 and was old enough to vote in North Korea's elections, which always returned Kim Jong-il with 100% approval. The inspectors wanted to know where you were. The Panjang was with them. I said we were visiting Aunt Pretty in Hamhung. The Panjang doesn't know it's not true, but you know how gossip gets around. There's already a rumour that you're in China. It was Chang Ho, my friend the border guard, who told her where I'd gone.
"She'll be back soon," he'd said cheerfully.
He'd always had more looks than brains. My mother had almost fainted. For the next few days she'd been in an agony of nerves. She knew she had to do something. So a week after telling the census inspectors I'd gone to Hamhung, she reported me missing to the police. "The rumour that you've been in China may be too strong for me to take care of if you suddenly reappear. You're young. You have your future ahead of you. I don't want you to live your life with this stain on your record." What did that mean? That I could not go back at all? Her voice was tense, urgent. "Our situation will be dangerous for a while. Don't contact us. The neighbours are watching us. We'll sell the house and move. I don't know where, but you know what I mean." I understood. My mother and Mino would have to move to a neighbourhood where people didn't know us and would accept the story that the family had a missing daughter. "I have to go," she said abruptly. There was a click as she hung up. The line went dead. The call had lasted under a minute. I handed the phone back to my uncle in a daze. I was perspiring as if I'd been for a hard run. There was something desperate about the way she'd ended the call, without even a goodbye. When I told my uncle and aunt what she'd said, they looked at each other.
"Well, then, you should stay in China," my aunt said gravely.
They were taken aback. They knew I had nowhere to go. "I didn't want to be a burden," I said, but they reassured me. Things would work out somehow. My aunt turned to stare out of the window. They were still digesting this news. I am ashamed to admit that my first emotion, when I was alone in my room, was relief. I was just glad that I didn't have to go back. I thought life in Shenyang was a marvellous vacation. Over the years to come, when my loneliness would become unbearable and the full realisation of the trouble I had brought upon my mother sank in, the memory of that relief would make me so guilty that I would lie awake at night. If I'd known that when reality began to bite, and I began to miss my mother, Mino, and my uncles and aunts in Heisan so much that the feeling was almost a physical pain, I would have disobeyed her and gone straight back to Heisan. Now that I was to stay indefinitely in China, I had to learn Mandarin. And I had the best teacher. Necessity. You can study a language for years at school, but nothing helps you succeed like need. And mine was clear and urgent. If I didn't want the apartment to become my prison, I had to become as fluent in Mandarin as any Chinese girl my age. My uncle started me off with a kindergarten book that I studied alone during the day and practiced in conversations with him and my aunt at night. I soon progressed to children's stories. I watched hours of television daily. As China has so many ethnic groups for whom Mandarin is a second language, most TV dramas and news had subtitles in Chinese characters. Not only was it more interesting to learn this way, but I didn't have to limit myself to kids' shows because I already had a basic grasp of characters, having learned them at school. I had my father to thank for that. Back then, I hadn't seen the point of learning them, but my father had been adamant. As a result, Chinese characters became one of my best subjects. Being free from all other distractions, I made fast progress in basic Mandarin. Recognizing a word in a subtitle that I had just learned was always a yes moment of satisfaction for me. For 6 months, I did little else apart from sneaking out for the occasional walk, and my days became monotonous. Each morning I felt more and more homesick. Eventually, the day came when I stared out at the rain, seeing the other apartment towers disappear up into cloud like unfinished sketches, and it dawned on me. I will never go home. Over the next few days, this realization took such a hold that I thought I was losing my sanity. It was a disaster, and I had not seen it coming. I'm never going to see my mother or Mino again. My mind's eye endlessly reran the taxi ride along the river, and that final second when I'd seen my house through the trees. Why didn't I ask the driver to pull over and let me out? I couldn't stop thinking of that last phone call from my mother. How desperate she'd sounded. And we didn't even say goodbye. I was trapped in a foreign country with no identity. My aunt and uncle were being good to me, but our family connection was so distant it was beginning to make me uncomfortable. I would not be able to trespass on their kindness forever. The day would come when they'd want me to go. What if I were to go home now? No, I couldn't. I had come too far. It was too late. My cousin had left a guitar behind when he moved away. I started playing the songs I used to sing in North Korea. These would make me cry. I cried every day, so much that it became impossible to conceal from my uncle and aunt. They were sympathetic, but I could sense they were getting fed up with me. I didn't blame them. At about this time, I had the first nightmare. I dreamed that my mother had been arrested by the Puibu and sent to a labor camp, one of the political zones of no return, and had died there. Minol was now an orphan and a beggar. I saw him, so vividly in my dream, walking alone along a desolate dirt track. He was in rags and barefoot. His features had turned mean and he was obsessed with food, like a feral dog. I felt paralyzed with guilt. The dream changed scene. Before she died, my mother had written to me. It began, "My dear daughter, I'm so sorry that I went first and that I couldn't take care of Minol." I woke up gasping for air. When I realized it was a dream, I started to sob and became hysterical. The noise woke my aunt. She ran in to see what was wrong and held me as I cried. It had been so lucid, this dream, that I was convinced something very bad had happened. There was no way to know. The next day I was subdued. I felt bereaved. The following night I had the second nightmare. I had sneaked over the frozen river and was walking alone through a deserted Haesan. It was nighttime and nothing was lit. It was like a city of the dead. I went to my house. Through the window I could make out my mother and Minol huddled together. My mother was weeping and Minol was comforting her. They had no money and no food. It was all my fault. I could only watch. If I entered the gate, the neighbors would see me and inform on me. I walked to the river to find Chang Ho. I felt guilty about him, too. I saw him patrolling the bank, but I couldn't approach him, so I hid in some trees and watched from a distance. Suddenly, Puibu agents emerged from the shadows all around me. I ran for my life back across the ice to China, with the sounds of whistles and police dogs behind me. Then I woke up. These two dreams would replay over and over again. The same scenes played on a loop, hundreds of times, night after night. Any feeling that I was living a liberated life of excitement and discovery in Shenyang had vanished. From that summer of 1998, I had entered a long, lonely valley. I deserved my fate. I had brought this upon myself. If the chance came now, I would do it, I thought. I will go back. By now, I knew that North Korea was not the greatest country on earth. Not one of the Korean-Chinese friends of my uncle and aunt had a good word to say about the place, and the Chinese media seemed to regard it as a relic, an embarrassment. Shenyang's newspapers openly lampooned Kim Jong-il. I didn't care about any of that. My country was wherever my mother and Minol lived. It was where my memories were from. It was where I'd been happy. The very things I'd regarded as symbols of our backwardness, I now missed the most. Burning yuntan, kerosene lamps, even Korea Central Television, with its pioneer ensembles playing accordions. The simplicity of life. One thing was for sure. I'd never known true misery until now. One morning when my uncle and aunt had gone to work, I called Mr. An's number in Changbai, hoping he could pass a message to my mother. His phone was no longer in service. I got a dead signal each time I tried. In the end, I called his next-door neighbor, Mr. Chang, the other trader my mother knew. He was very angry to receive my call. "Why are you calling me?" I want to send a message to my mother. What are you talking about? I don't know you.
Yes, you...
Don't ever call this number again, he shouted, and hung up. I thought perhaps he'd been drunk, and so I tried again the next day. This time, the line was dead. My lifelines to Heisan had been cut. Aunt Sanghee became desperate to pull me out of my despair. I was becoming a serious worry to her. I had no role in life, and she could see I was becoming depressed. She began to hatch a plan that she thought would be the solution to my situation. I knew nothing about it until one evening when the doorbell rang. I was in my bedroom, as usual, playing sad songs on the guitar. She knocked softly on the door and told me I had a visitor. My heart leapt. My depressed mind was making all kinds of irrational connections. I thought maybe it was someone from Heisan. I followed her into the living room. A tall young man I did not recognize was standing on the rug, holding a bunch of pink azaleas. He was in his mid-twenties and looking sweaty and ill at ease in a jacket and tie. My aunt beamed. Miran, she said, using my alias. This is Gunsu. It's my pleasure to meet you, he said, using the honorific form of address. He bowed and presented me with the azaleas, but his eyes did not meet mine. Chapter 22 The Wedding Trap. Gunsu, my aunt explained, was the son of her good friend Mrs. Jang, a member of her Korean-Chinese social circle. He was gangly and so nondescript, I'm not sure I would have picked him out in a crowd. He had the sallow complexion of someone whose pursuits all took place indoors, and an adolescent sheen to his skin. There was an awkward pause after the introductions were made. I looked at my aunt. To my mortification, she said, "Now, why don't you youngsters go out for an ice cream?" In an ice cream parlour near my uncle and aunt's apartment, I saw that Gunsu was even more uncomfortable than I was. To put him at ease, I suggested we share a tub of my favourite, the heavenly purple taro. He seemed to relax a little. He was 22, he told me, and had two older sisters. He'd graduated from a university in Shenyang, but seemed in no hurry to find a job. His family ran a successful chain of restaurants, and had money. He spoke with great deference about his widowed mother, more than I would have expected from a young man. It made him seem filial and kind, which I liked. He admitted that he enjoyed nights out drinking with his old college buddies. I thought he must be daring and fun. I knew no young people in North Korea who drank. This was the first of many dates with Gunsu. Over the following months, he would take me for walks in Beiling Park during the day, or to noodle bars, or out to an Arebang bar, the Korean version of karaoke, in the evenings. He was harmless, but I soon began to find him glib and uninspiring. I felt no emotional bond. No matter how hard I challenged him to an interesting discussion, even to the point of provoking him, he seemed unable to offer a firm opinion on anything. We often spent our dates in silence. I got the feeling that when he wasn't seeing me, he spent his days playing video games. He also had such a devotion to his mother that I began to dread meeting her. He seemed content for her to decide everything for him. Gunsu knew that I was North Korean, but believed my name was Che Miran. I saw no reason to reveal my real name to him. In fact, I was getting so used to being called Miran, it felt as if I was shedding the name Min Young like a former skin. I went along with the dating and would occasionally hold Gunsu's hand. The relationship wasn't serious. It was pleasing my uncle and aunt. It helped to keep me distracted as the Western New Year passed again, then my 19th birthday, then the Chinese New Year, and to ward off miserable thoughts that it was now well over a year since I'd last seen my mother and Mino. I should have seen the warning lights when Gunsu began urging me to improve my Mandarin and correcting me on points of etiquette. When he took me to meet his mother, I was made to feel the significance of the occasion. The family apartment was far larger and more luxurious than my uncle and aunt's. Mrs. Jang greeted me in the hallway. I had never seen such a rich lady. She was elegant and very slim. Her hair was pulled back in a mother-of-pearl barrette. She wore an Hermes scarf around her neck and beautiful Japanese pearl jewellery.
"Welcome, Miran," she said.
Her smile was tepid. I could guess what she was thinking. A North Korean girl was beneath her son. Yet I also knew from Jensu that she did not approve of him dating Chinese girls, a cultural prejudice against the Chinese shared by many ethnic Koreans. Mrs. Jang was a pragmatic, calculating woman. She was willing to put her misgivings aside because she thought a North Korean girl would make a compliant and obedient wife. After all, I wasn't illegal, and hardly in any position to complain. She also knew that I was raised in a culture that revered elders. I would be submissive to her, my mother-in-law. Although her conversation was excruciatingly polite, I watched her looking me up and down as if she were inspecting livestock. Over the next few months, whenever I was taken to Gunsu's home, Mrs. Jang began to talk about my future with her son. The family would open a new restaurant for him and me to manage together, she said. Not long after that, without anyone asking me what I felt about the idea, she was mentioning marriage. Her son was a little too young to marry, she told me, but out of consideration towards her, he wanted to provide her with grandchildren as soon as possible. I began to feel caught in a gathering wave. Gunsu had not proposed marriage to me. In fact, I wasn't even sure how he felt about me. I found it difficult to picture him getting aroused and passionate about anything. Perhaps he became livelier when he went out drinking. But it was clear that he was keeping that side of his life separate from me. He was passive in all his mother's schemes. My dates with him started to become stifling. He kept repeating the need to improve my Mandarin, and would correct me often. His main concern seemed to be that I should not embarrass his family by making mistakes when I spoke. I felt as if I had been enrolled in a training program to join his family, without once having given my assent. My situation was becoming deeply awkward, because my uncle and aunt saw marriage as the solution to my problem, and to theirs. My 5-day visit had already turned into a stay of nearly 2 years. One afternoon towards the end of 1999, when I was at Gunsu's home, Mrs. Jang came home laden with department store shopping bags and mentioned, quite casually, that she had given my birth details to a fortune teller who had recommended a propitious date in the summer for our wedding. And she had found a home for us in a nearby apartment, she said. She would soon start choosing our furniture. That evening, lying on my bed, I was forced to examine, really, truly examine, whether I had any options. I tried to think calculatingly, like Mrs. Jang. Regardless of my feelings about the feckless Gunsu, I asked myself whether this marriage would help me or trap me. I knew I had a desire to be a businesswoman and to travel, but if I were to marry now and have children, I'd have to put any career on hold. On the other hand, my position was precarious. I could not stay at my uncle and aunt's much longer. I had no prospects, least of all of becoming a businesswoman. The alternative was a life on the run. And if I'm caught? Arrest, repatriation, beatings, prison camp. The ruin of my family's Songbun. A spasm of terror ran through me. No matter which way I looked at it, I had no choice. So I tried hard to convince myself. Gunsu's all right. A girl could do a lot worse. If I married him, I'd have a comfortable life without fear, and a Chinese ID. I spent weeks thinking these thoughts, arguing in silence with myself. There was just one problem, however, and it was a major one. I wasn't choosing any of this. It was all happening to me. Through connections, Gunsu's family obtained a new identity for me. He even showed me the ID card and let me hold it. I recognized my face, but not the name. It was a new name, another one I had not chosen. I was to be a Korean Chinese called Jang Sun Xiang. As I was too young to marry, The legal marriage age in China is 20. They'd made me older.
You'll get it after the wedding, Gunsu said with a smirk, and picked it out of my hands. Even he could tell I was having misgivings, more so when I learned that my new name meant the person who respects elders and makes a good wife by following her husband and listening really well to him.
The millennium passed, then another birthday. My uncle gave me a Motorola cell phone as a present, so that I could chat with Junsu whenever I liked, he said. The wedding plans gathered pace. Mrs. Jiang sensed that I was feeling pressured by her will. She tried to reassure me.
After you're married, we'll take care of you, she said, squeezing my hand with her bony fingers and rings. You won't have to worry about a thing.
It was kind of her to say that. It emboldened me to ask the question I wanted to ask. I don't know why I thought I had to ask her permission.
When I married, would it be all right to visit my family?
I thought my new Chinese ID would mean I could visit North Korea legally. We were sitting around the kitchen table at her home. Mrs. Jiang and Gunsu's two sisters stared at me in horror.
Oh, no, 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 she said, as if there'd been some gross misunderstanding. You can never go back. Do you understand?
Her voice carried an edge of warning.
They might find out who you are. Then we'd all be in trouble. We've had to break rules to get your ID as it is. In fact, it's too dangerous even to contact your family again.
She saw the shock on my face, and she gave a thin, quick smile, like a sudden crack in the ice.
After you marry, you will have a new family. You will join our family.
When I told Gunsu what his mother had said, I was still emotional. He knew how badly I wanted to see my mother and Mino again. I thought this was his moment, to comfort his future wife, show understanding, tell me we'd find a way to achieve it somehow, and not to worry. Instead, he said blandly, "My mother's right. It's for the best." He wasn't even looking at me. He was playing a video game. I was stunned. He and my future in-laws were closing down any talk of my seeing my family again. If I even managed to contact them, I would have to keep it secret from those closest to me. I looked at Gunsu's face, pale in the reflected light of the video game, and knew I could not marry this man. Whatever happened next, I would be on my own. But I didn't care. I would find a way to fly in life. I didn't know how, but I would take my chances. My uncle and aunt were talking excitedly about the wedding at almost every mealtime. I could not bear to tell them of my decision, or to witness their disappointment. I was fearful, too, that Mrs. Jiang might feel so angry and humiliated by the loss of face that she would report me to the authorities as a fugitive. I had no one to talk to. The situation left only one door open. Escape. It was the summer of 2000. The wedding was just weeks away. I thought hard about when I would make my move. It was a phone call from Gunsu that decided the matter for me. He told me that his mother, without asking us, had booked our honeymoon at a luxurious beach resort at Sanya, on the South China Sea. That did it. I would leave straight away. I threw some clothes into a bag and waited until my aunt and uncle had left for work. I took the elevator down to the lobby and smiled at the caretaker. The blood was rushing to my temples. A memory flashed across my mind of my foot stepping onto the ice of the Yalu River. I walked calmly out of the apartment building, took the chip out of my cell phone, and dropped it in a trash can. Chapter 23. Shenyang Girl. The cab driver's eyes regarded me in the mirror, waiting for me to say where to go. I was in an agony of hesitation. I had no plan. For the first time in my life, I had no one to turn to. Shenyang is a vast metropolis. I could go anywhere. But my gut feeling told me to stay away from the district known as Shita, or West Pagoda. This was Shunyang's Koreatown, where most of the city's ethnic Koreans lived and ran businesses. If anyone searched for me, it would be there. I told the driver to head to a district I did not know, on the opposite side of the city, where no one would find me. I would have to speak Mandarin, but after 2 years of study, my ability was adequate. I felt I could handle things. But once we were on the freeway and passing through unfamiliar districts, I was again filled with doubts. Although it was risky, the best chance of finding a job and someone to help me would be in Cheetah, among Koreans. I had been there several times with my aunt and remembered seeing an informal job market where people hung about, waiting to be offered a casual day's work. And I needed to find work fast. My uncle had been giving me some modest living expenses, but I had only saved enough to last me a couple of days. I told the driver to change direction and head to Cheetah. Among the crowd of job seekers, I didn't know whether to appear eager or nonchalant. I'd been standing there only a few minutes when a woman approached me and spoke in Mandarin. "Hello," she said brightly. "Are you looking for a job?" She was middle-aged, but with very girlish makeup and a cotton dress that showed bare shoulders. "Yes. I'm the manager of a hair salon and need another stylist. Are you interested?" Her voice was girlish too. "You'll be trained, and the lodgings are free." I could not believe my luck. "It's on the edge of the city. We can go by cab. It'll take about 30 minutes. Her name was Miss Ma. On the way there, she asked me many questions. I felt she was trying to befriend me. I told her I was from Shunyang, and that my father owned a trading company that did business with South Korea. She expressed surprise that a girl from such a family would want a job in a hair salon. I tried to give the impression I was rebelling. I noticed that Miss Ma's nails were painted a cyclamen purple, which I thought rather far out for a woman her age, and she wore a thin gold trace chain around her ankle. We arrived at a drab suburb of shops and apartments. It looked more like Changbai than Shunyang. The hair salon was unlike any beauty parlour I had known. The left side was lined with black leather sofas, and on the right were half a dozen barber's chairs facing large mirrors. Two of the chairs were occupied by middle-aged men having their hair shampooed. This is a men's hair salon. Another man of about 50 was sprawled on one of the sofas reading a newspaper and smoking. He tapped his ash into a paper cup. I noticed something peeping above his shirt collar, the blue head of a serpent tattooed on his neck. Miss Ma greeted him, and his eyes followed me without smiling. Without my needing to be told, I knew this man was the boss. Miss Ma led me down into the basement and pointed out six small therapy rooms with smoked glass doors. She told me this was where I would be working. Her tone was less friendly now. There was a stale yellow light. It smelled of damp and male sweat. She opened the door to one of the rooms, and I heard myself gasp. Inside, lit only by a tea light, a young woman in a skimpy slip was sitting beside a man lying on a futon on his stomach. He was naked but for a white towel around his waist. Coming from prudish North Korea, I had never been in an environment where men and women mingled naked, let alone touched each other. She was massaging one of his arms. What is this place?
"Here, why don't you massage the other arm?" the girl said.
Without another word, Miss Ma closed the door and left. I didn't even know what massage was for, let alone how to give one. The man was very fat and shining with sweat, as if he'd just come out of the sauna. In the dim light, he looked like some sea mammal that had washed ashore and begun to rot. I touched him with extreme reluctance. I couldn't see his face. After a few seconds, he said, "Who's this? She's hopeless."
"She's new," my co-worker said. "We're training her."
The girl gave me an imploring look, as if I was getting her into trouble. She was about my own age, small and pretty, but with a damaged look in her eyes. After a while, the man heaved himself up, took a good look at me, and invited both of us to join him in a karaoke bar a short drive away.
"I don't think we're allowed to do that," I said.
"Don't be silly," my co-worker laughed. "Of course we are."
Upstairs, the man with the blue serpent tattoo stood to open the glass doors for us and flagged down a taxi. I hadn't eaten anything and my stomach was churning with nerves. I was worried that events were going to take an even weirder turn in the karaoke bar, but the fat man lost interest in me after I twice declined an alcoholic drink. It seemed to deflate whatever plans he had for a night with two girls. My co-worker, however, joined him in several shots of soju. I sang a few Chinese songs. He sang some himself. By the time we took a taxi back, it was dark. My co-worker took me to a building at the back of the hair salon. We climbed several flights of narrow stairs to a door with multiple locks. She opened it, turned on the light, and I saw the filthiest room I had seen in my life. In the corner, something scuttled and vanished. 5 bunk beds were crammed into a tiny space. 10 girls were living here. It stank of body odour and drains. A line of drying panties was strung between bunks. Clothes were strewn across the beds. I peered into the bathroom and pressed my hand to my nose and mouth. This is what I've escaped to. I was very tired by now and weak from having eaten nothing but a few bar snacks. I said, "If it's all right with you, I'll stay tonight because it's late, but I'll leave in the morning. I don't think I'm going to take this job." I'll never forget the look that came into the girl's eyes. I'd seen it many times in North Korea. She was afraid.
"This is not the kind of place you can just leave," she said.
"What do you mean?"
Her voice fell to a whisper.
"They won't let you."
I lay awake all night on a stained mattress. I was too scared to sleep. It was very humid and the room had no ventilation. Was this my fate as an illegal? To live in places like this? How could they make me stay against my will? They couldn't chain me. I was trying to make sense of the fear in my co-worker's eyes, and the answer presented itself. "They'll harm me if I try to leave." I had been a complete fool. Miss Ma had guessed I was an illegal the moment she saw me. The woman had tricked me to get me here. I would need to employ the same tactic to leave. I would have to trick her back. The next morning, the other beds were still empty. Whoever they belonged to had slept elsewhere. My co-worker and I went to the salon. I was relieved to see that the brute with the blue serpent tattoo was not there. Miss Ma was sitting behind the cash register, looking gaudily dolled up. I walked towards her. I needed to put on an act, and a good one. "We had such a time at the karaoke," I said. I held my hand to my head as if I had a hangover, and gave a look of comic mock despair.
"Good."
She gave a small, sour smile.
"That's what you're here for? How much did the gentleman tip you?"
He hadn't given me anything. "The money's in my jeans in the dorm," I said. "I was in no state to count it last night."
"Never leave the money there. Always bring it straight here."
"Sure, sorry.
When do I meet the other girls?"
"They'll be here when they're ready."
I crossed my fingers for luck. "Before it gets busy, I'm going to pop back to Shita and get my things." Her eyes hardened. All of yesterday's friendliness had gone.
"What do you need? I will provide it."
"Oh, no," I laughed. "I wouldn't ask you to provide a guitar. That's all I want to fetch. And some personal photos. The guitar won't get in the way. In fact, everything will fit underneath the bunk." I pretended to worry that she thought my stuff would take up too much space.
"You'll be late for your first booking if you go anywhere."
She's hesitating.
"I'll make up for it later with overtime, and I won't waste your money on a taxi," I said.
I'll go by bus and pay for it myself. I'll be back here by 10. She huffed and puffed. She was annoyed now, and glanced towards the window. I wondered if she was looking for the man with the blue serpent tattoo.
Be quick. We're fully booked today.
Understood, I said, giving her a cheery salute, as if to say, you're the boss. I walked out of the glass doors. When I was around the corner and out of sight, I ran along the sidewalk to the cab rank where we'd been dropped off the previous night after the karaoke. I stopped dead in my tracks. The driver of the first free cab was leaning against his car talking to the man with the blue serpent tattoo, who had a newspaper under his arm. I turned on my heels and walked back the way I had come, hoping he had not seen me. This meant that I had to walk back past the glass front of the hair salon. If Miss Ma saw me, she would know I was not going to the bus stop. I hung back for a moment and tried to walk past with some other people, as if I was one of them. I was halfway past the salon when I heard her shout from inside, "Hey!" I ran, down one street after another. I didn't know where I was. When I saw the amber light of a free cab coming towards me, I flagged it down like a madwoman. I jumped in and sank low into the back seat. This time there was no hesitation. Sheeta, go, go, go! Chapter 24. Guilt Call. I had not slept and had hardly eaten in 36 hours, running on pure adrenaline. I had no possessions. My bag had been left behind in the dorm. In the cab, I counted the last of the cash in my wallet. It was enough to pay the driver and buy some fried noodles at a market stall. After that, I was in serious trouble. I had to find a job today. Back in Koreatown, I decided to try the restaurants, which seemed a safer option than the casual job market. After walking into a dozen of them to ask for work, and having no luck, I caught sight of my reflection in a window. I looked hollow-eyed, hungry, and desperate. Just a yard from my face, however, was a notice in Korean attached to the inside of the glass. It was advertising for a waitress. I was in front of a restaurant called Jonghwaru, a large and busy establishment, with about 30 round tables and at least 10 waitresses I could see gliding about in the traditional chimajigori dress. The lunchtime rush was on, huge trays of hot food going in one direction, empty plates in the other. I composed myself and went in. "I want to be a waitress," I said to the lady at the drinks counter, who looked like she might be the manager. She wore formal business clothes.
"You're a student looking for vacation work?"
"No, I'd like a full-time job."
She fetched a form and a pen.
"Name?"
"Jangsun Xiang," I said, using the name from the identity Gunsu's family had obtained for me.
"I'm Korean-Chinese, from Yanbian." There was a pause as she wrote this down, and I felt my stomach turn to water. It had not occurred to me till now that I would need ID to find work. If her next question was to ask for my ID, the game was up. She seemed to spend a long time filling out the form.
"I can give you a job. We have a dormitory for workers who need it. It's 2 minutes away."
I felt relief wash over me.
Nowhere in the world could be as squalid as the dorm I'd just come from.
"When can you start?"
"Today," I said, tapping the counter in a show of eagerness. The woman gave me a curious look.
"Isn't there something you'd like to know?"
"You don't need to see any ID?"
"No, sounds great."
"You're not interested in your pay?"
I'd been so desperate for a lifeline that I'd not asked the most basic question.
"It's 350 yuan a month," she said, the equivalent of about 40 US dollars. In North Korea, I could survive 6 months on a sum like that. It seemed a generous wage to me.
The lady smiled.
"And meals are free." My first day as a waitress in the Jonghwaru Korean restaurant nearly ended in catastrophe. My very first customers were a table of Han Chinese businessmen in suits. One of them asked me for the check and some chewing gum. I brought them to him.
What's this?
He looked up at me. I sensed abuse coming. I'd already noticed this was common in restaurants here. Some people thought that if they were spending money, they had the right to be as rude as they liked.
I didn't ask for this.
I'm sorry, sir, you asked for gum?
I said cigarette, not gum.
His eyes narrowed. He must have said the Mandarin word Changyan, cigarette. But I'd heard Kushangtang, gum. The lady manager came over to us. Is something the matter?
Yes,
the man said, pointing at me in front of his colleagues.
She's from North Korea.
The colour drained from my face. She's from Yanbian, the manager said softly. She didn't catch your meaning.
Bullshit! People her age from Yanbian speak Mandarin perfectly well these days. She didn't understand me. She's North Korean.
She's Korean Chinese, the manager said with a firm smile. I do apologize for the mistake. Let me bring you each a packet of cigarettes with our compliments. This seemed to calm him down and he dropped the matter. Later, the manager told me that some customers behaved like pigs in order to get something for free. She told me not to feel upset. She had not suspected that the man was right. I fell into a routine. I arrived for work at 8:30 a.m. to set tables, fill salt shakers and soy sauce bottles, and waited on tables all day until the last customers left at 10 p.m. The restaurant was open every day, and the waitresses got one day off each month. It was hard work, but I didn't mind. I was proud that I'd solved my problem by myself, even if my situation was still far from secure. For the first time in my life, I had some independence. I had some money of my own. My Mandarin improved rapidly. I returned to the dorm after work each evening, so exhausted that I'd drop off straight away. I got used to the nightmares. They still repeated, on an endless loop, night after night. The four waitresses who shared the dorm were friendly and talkative, but I was guarded about what I revealed, especially to the two who were from Yanbian. One slip, and they might easily guess the truth about me. Despite this, one of the girls intrigued me, and we became friends. Her name was Jiu. She was putting herself through a business studies degree at Dongbei University in Shenyang and paying her way with waitressing. This impressed me so much. The only other young person I'd met in China who'd been through higher education was Gunsu, but he'd been such an indifferent student, he couldn't even describe for me what he'd studied. Jiu was fun and intelligent, and like me, loved fashion. I wanted to learn what she was learning about business models, but her textbook seemed so difficult. Several times I was tempted to tell her my secret, but each time a warning voice in my head said, "Don't." I was getting used to another new name. Jihe, Minyoung, Miran were behind me. My name was now Sunhyang, and I wore it like a new bud. After a few months waiting tables, I was assigned to the cash register. I was good at handling money. My monthly wage was now 500 yuan, $60. My goal was to save enough money for the journey to Shanghai. From there, I would try to make contact with my mother and Mino. I was enjoying the job. The people who came to the restaurant fascinated me. I found myself observing customers, trying to guess their stories. I started to see that the world was far less conventional than I'd ever imagined in North Korea. People were complex and diverse. Many lifestyles and choices were possible. As my life became more settled, the memory of how I'd run away from my uncle and aunts troubled me. I'd fled without even leaving them a note. They had been kind to me. How could I have been so disrespectful? I realized that a note would have required explaining my feelings, and I was not accustomed to doing that. Few North Koreans are. After about 6 months, in December 2000,
I called them from a street phone. Aunt Sanghee answered.
Miran,
she said in a gasp. Even she had forgotten my real name. Once she got over her shock, I could hear the conflict in her voice, between relief, concern for me, and wounded pride. You humiliated us, she said. You're our family. Running away like that made us all look bad. I'm so sorry, I couldn't go through with it. She wanted to know where I was. I told her I was waitressing and doing fine. She invited me to visit, but I sensed that the hurt I caused was still raw. I would leave it a while. Don't you want to know what happened to Gunsu? She said. I don't want to know. You must call the family to apologize. I brooded about this for 2 days, but I knew I had to do it. Several times I started punching in the number only for my courage to fail me at the last second. Finally, I made the call. Mrs. Jiang answered. I couldn't talk at first. My mouth had gone dry. She was about to hang up when I said, It's Miran.
Oh, my God.
There was a long pause.
Where are you?
I could picture her gesturing furiously to the sisters.
It's her.
I thought she would be hissing with fury, but her voice was cool and controlled. To my great surprise, she said, Please come back, Miran, for my son's sake. He's not the same. He's been very depressed since you left. Gunsu is depressed over me. Could I talk to him? He was weeping when he came to the phone. He sounded drunk and couldn't form his words properly. Please come back, he said. I still have the honeymoon tickets. We can go away. These were the first strong sentiments I'd ever heard from him. I felt very sorry for him, and dismayed. I'd had to abandon him before he was able to figure out how he felt about me. But it was too late. I could not go back. The clearest desire in my mind was to reconnect with my family. He and his mother would be a barrier to that. I kept saying over and over how sorry I was. I had humiliated him and insulted his family. When the call ended, I slumped against the wall next to the payphone and buried my face in my hands. I had brought great misfortune upon Gunsu. Our respected father leader commands that we respect our elders and honour our families. I have noticed that Comrade Miran does nothing but hurt the people closest to her. Would she agree that she is a person of bad character? Yes, that's what I was. A bad person. I had no one to talk to, no one who might have told me that, for my own well-being, the choice I had made did not make me bad. Instead, this scathing self-assessment sank in, and a part of me turned cold. When I was crying in my uncle's apartment, missing my mother, my heart was there. But now something inside me had hardened, and the tears had stopped. I no longer liked myself. I swore that I would do penance for the harm I had done Gunsu. For weeks, I thought about how I might do this. In the end, I decided that my punishment would be never to marry. I would not add to the hurt and insult I had caused him by marrying someone else. Whenever people asked when I would marry, I got into the habit of saying, Never. It's not important to me. Chapter 25 The Men from the South. In January 2001, two sleek young men came into the restaurant at lunchtime. They were friendly and asked me about Shenyang. They had perfect teeth, I noticed. That day we were short-staffed, so I was waiting tables. I was laying out banchan dishes in front of them when one of them spoke in a low voice. You wouldn't know any North Koreans, would you? I avoided their eyes. Why do you want to know? They put their business cards on the table and told me they were filmmakers from one of South Korea's main television stations. We're making a documentary,
one of them said. We want to find a North Korean defector trying to reach South Korea. We'll pay the broker's fees to make sure they get there, and any other expenses. I was taken aback. The North and South were mortal enemies. The Korean War had ended in 1953 with a ceasefire, not a peace treaty. The two countries were still at war. How can a North Korean go to South Korea? I said. This was the first I'd heard of such a thing. Many come these days, the man said. I told them I'd ask around. I walked away intrigued. Am I the one you're looking for? Each day the two men came in for lunch. I was seriously considering telling them my secret, but my instinct was urging extreme caution. This could be a trap. Before I did anything rash, I needed some facts. I told Jiu, my dorm friend, what the South Koreans had said to me, sounding as casual as I could. What she said in response came as a massive surprise. South Korea considered all North Koreans to be South Korean citizens, she said. Any who succeeded in reaching Seoul were given a South Korean passport and quite a large allowance to help them resettle. This got me thinking. I knew from my uncle and aunt that South Korea was not the hell on earth portrayed by the party's propaganda. My uncle had visited the South on business and told me it was even richer and freer than China. I thought he was exaggerating. In truth, I had given very little thought to South Korea. I had been so focused on learning Mandarin that I had not even watched South Korean soap operas on the cable channels. I also still believed that the North's problems were all down to the Yankee-backed UN sanctions. Going to pro-Yankee South Korea would be a betrayal of my own country, wouldn't it? What's more, I remembered that on the rare occasion someone had defected to North Korea, the party propagandists had held a press conference. If I defected to the South, wouldn't I have to do the same, in front of a bank of microphones and flashing cameras? That could get my family into terrible trouble. I was still undecided when, after a week, the two South Koreans stopped coming to the restaurant. They must have found what they were looking for. Uncle Opium had once told me you get three chances in life. I couldn't shake the feeling that I'd just let a major one go flying past my ears. That evening, I went on a night out with the dorm girls. We ate skewered lamb from a market food stall, then went to a cafe for bubble milk tea. The girls chatted about their private lives, family worries, boyfriend problems. Each one of them wanted a better life. One of them, a Korean-Chinese girl from Yangbian, gave me a sideways look and said, "You never say much about yourself. You're not an orphan, are you?" For months, I had dreaded the curiosity of others. But after the missed opportunity with the filmmakers, I was feeling reckless. It was my extreme caution that had caused me to miss the chance. I was sick of lying. "No, not an orphan," I said. I had a habit of pausing before I spoke, to give myself a second to weigh the consequences. This time I came straight out with it. "I'm from North Korea." The girls looked at each other. Jiu, the most savvy of the group, said she'd had no idea. Suddenly they were intensely interested. So I told them my story. We were in the cafe until closing time. For the first time, I became curious about other